This is Fresh Air Weekend. I'm Dave Davies in for Terry Gross. We're going to listen to Terry's interview with Richard Zoglin, author of a new biography of Bob Hope. For many people, Bob Hope's comedy is remembered as being dated and sometimes offensive. But Zoglin thinks that if you examine the entirety of Hope's career and view his achievements from a distance, it's clear he was the most popular entertainer of the 20th century, having achieved success in every major genre of entertainment. Zoglin's new biography of Bob Hope is called Hope. Zoglin is also the author of the 2008 book Comedy at the Edge, How Stand-Up in the 1970s Changed America.
Richard Zoglin, welcome to Fresh Air.
Great to be here.
I want to start with what is my favorite Bob Hope scene that I think might be yours too, and it's also the scene that made him a star. It's from the 1938 film The Big Broadcast of 1938, in which he sings a really lovely and also heartbreaking duet with Shirley Ross of the song Thanks for the Memory, and a song that became his theme song. Would you set the scene for us? We're going to hear not the recording of it. We're going to hear the actual song from the movie. Set the scene for us about what's happening as they sing this.
Sure. Bob Hope is a radio broadcaster, and he's on a transatlantic race, a big transatlantic liner, and he discovers that his ex-wife, one of his three ex-wives, is actually on the boat with him. They get together in the ship's bar, and they kind of gently reminisce about their failed marriage, and then very naturally sort of slide into the song, Thanks for the Memory.
So this is Bob Hope and Shirley Ross. We're actually going to pick this up in the middle of the song because I want everybody to hear the ending of it. So this is from the Big Broadcast of 1938.
Thanks for the memory of gardens at Versailles
and beef and kidney pie.
The night you worked and then came home with lipstick on your tie.
How lovely that was.
Huh?
For the memory of lingerie with lace.
Yes, and Pilsner by the case. And how I jumped the day you trumped my one and only ace.
How lovely that was.
We said goodbye with a highball.
Then I got as high as a steeple.
Did you?
But we were intelligent people.
Tears, no fuss.
Hooray for us.
Strictly entre-nous. Darling, how are you?
And how are all those little dreams that never did come true?
Awfully glad I met you.
Cheerio, toodaloo.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Oh, Buzz.
Darling, I know. I know, dear.
That was Bob Hope and Shirley Ross from the Big Broadcast of 1938. And my guest, Richard Zoglin, is the author of the new book, Hope, about Bob Hope. That is just so beautiful. And I always feel like he's never given enough credit for his singing. That was really lovely. So what did that scene do for him? Is that scene made him a star?
That scene did make him a star. He appeared, that was his first movie in Hollywood. He came to Hollywood fairly late. He was 34 years old. You know, many of his other contemporaries were already big stars. Bing Crosby, Burns and Allen, Jack Benny were already movie stars. Bob Hope was just getting there. This film was starring W.C. Fields. There was also kind of an all-star cast. Martha Ray was in it. All other people, most of the other people were bigger stars than Bob Hope. Bob was the newcomer, but he who was the MC of the shipboard entertainment, and he really stood out in the film.
Now, your previous book was about the history of stand-up comedy. Did that book lead to your new book, which is all about Bob Hope?
Definitely. My book was about stand-up comedy in the 70s, actually, or the generation that came after Lenny Bruce, from George Carlin, Richard Pryor, Robert Klein, Steve Martin, that whole generation up through Jerry Seinfeld. When I interviewed most of these people, the ones who are still around, and asked, I would always ask them who their influences were, who they grew up listening to, and if they didn't mention Lenny Bruce, because they all considered themselves in the Lenny Bruce rebel comedy generation, they might mention, you know, some of the old-timers, the comedy classic comedians from Groucho Marx, maybe Jack Benny. Nobody ever mentioned Bob Hope. It was very strange, and it made me realize how off the radar he was for, you know, many reasons. He had sort of slipped away from a generation, largely because of Vietnam, I would say, and they didn't really find him relevant. And I thought that was really unjust because, in my opinion, when I look back at stand-up comedy, I always was wondering who kind of started stand-up comedy. And I really think you have to say it was Bob Hope, the kind of stand-up comedy that we think of today that most comedians do, and that is comedy that is about something. In the comedians who preceded Bob Hope in vaudeville were mostly doing packaged vaudeville-style routines. Think of Burns and Allen, people with a partner. They used to do ethnic gags or something. Bob Hope, when he came along, when he came on the radio in 1938, all the other radio comedians, too, had their own little comedy worlds or their character. Jack Benny was the cheap guy. Bob Hope didn't have that. So he knew he had to build his show out of jokes. And he told his writers to read the papers, come up with lines, you know, of what's happening in the world or what's happening in Bob Hope's life, his golf game or his friendship with Crosby or something. And this whole idea of having stand-up comedy week after week that actually drew on the outside world was, believe it or not, something new. And that, of course, is what every stand-up comedian does today, pretty much.
Well, this would be a good opportunity to actually listen to one of his very early radio broadcasts in which he did an opening comic monologue. So this takes us back to November 8th, 1938, Election Day. And I think it's maybe like his fourth broadcast in this series of his Pepsodent radio show. Back in those days, radio shows had one sponsor and the name often incorporated, the name of the show often incorporated the name of the sponsor, and Pepsodent, the sponsor, made toothpaste. So
yes.
I thought instead of just starting with the opening monologue, we'd start with the opening theme song, which is a Pepsodent version of Thanks for the Memory. So here's Bob Hope, recorded in November of 1938 on Election Day.
The Pepsodent Show, starring Bob Hope.
Glad we found you in, for now we can begin. Bob Hope brings you his laugh review, and smiles are here again.
Ah, thank you so much, and welcome you all to our fun shop. While we manufacture the laughter, it's Pepsodent sales that we're after. To make your smile the more worthwhile. How do you do, ladies and gentlemen? This is Bob Hope back again for the GOP. Good old Pepsodent. Tonight, I'm just a lull between election returns. You know, there's been so many campaign speeches on the air lately, I turned on my radio last night and it handed me a cigar. And what those politicians say about each other, it sounded like they were doing their Christmas wrapping early. Well, election day is almost over and I'm pretty tired. My uncle ran for office in Eagle Knob, California. And I've been voting all day. But it doesn't pay to be honest. I voted 12 times a day and I only got paid for 10. When my uncle got through voting, the ballot box was so stuffed it had to take 6 bicarbonates of soda. My uncle isn't exactly crooked. I'd say he was sort of a pretzel with skin. When he was running for office last year, he said he'd do the public good. And when he was elected, he kept his word. He did them good.
So that was Bob Hope, recorded in 1938, one of his very first radio broadcasts in his series of radio shows. My guest, Richard Zoglin, is the author of a new biography of Bob Hope called Hope. So, you know, listening to that, listening to Bob Hope's early stand-up, you know, on the one hand, I really appreciate what you're saying is him kind of inventing a certain type of topical stand-up comedy. Some of the jokes sound kind of funny. Some of them just sound really dated or just kind of like not that good.
Yeah, well, there's still a lot of vaudeville in that routine. That's fairly early on. All the invented stuff about his uncle. He didn't have an uncle who ran for office. He probably wouldn't have done that kind of joke 10 years later. But the whole idea of at least jumping off of the election. Imagine Jack Benny or Bergen and McCarthy talking about the election. They just wouldn't do it. Bob was the only one doing that on radio at that time.
And you said he didn't have a comic persona like some of the other radio performers of the era. At what point did he start to create his persona?
The writers started to create it for him close to the beginning, and it took a season or two to develop. You know, he was cheap. He chased after women. He was always making jokes about the glamour girls in the movies at the time, whether it was Hedy Lamarr or Madeline Carroll or whoever. And then a lot of little quirks of his personality, the writers would start to work them in. They claim that they were basically just reflecting Bob's real personality. The cheapness was really there. There was a bit of an ego. And he was known as a guy who chased women. So they put that in. They created a character. But it was very close to Bob's real character.
If you're just joining us, my guest is Richard Zoglin, the author of a new biography of Bob Hope, which is called Hope. So Bob Hope starts in vaudeville, goes on to perform on Broadway. He gets his own radio show, and then he starts to make movies. The radio show and his first movie are in 1938. And one of the things he becomes famous for in the movies is teaming up with Bing Crosby in their road movies, The Road to Zanzibar, The Road to Morocco. Had they already worked together in vaudeville?
Bob worked with Bing for the first time in 1932 at the Capitol Theater in New York. Bing was already a big recording star, and Bob was asked to MC a show that Bing was going to do at the Capitol Theater. They actually, to entertain themselves, they just decided to do some bits together on stage, just some funny, little, silly little comedy bits together, and they worked so well together, they really loved working together. They then didn't see each other for 5 years because Bing went back to Hollywood where he was making movies and Bob stayed on Broadway for another 5 years. When Bob went out to Hollywood in 1937, he got friendly again with Crosby on the Paramount lot. And they were, you know, became good friends. They entertained together again at Del Mar Racetrack where Bing was a part owner. And Paramount executives saw their act on stage together and said, hey, these guys might work together in a movie. So they geared up a movie that ended up being called Road to Singapore. This came out in early 1940, and it was just terrific. It was the highest grossing film for 1940, in a year with a lot of big Hollywood films. And just the audience responded instantly to the chemistry of the two of them on screen together. They were relaxed, informal. They seemed to be friends, you know, authentically, not just movie characters. The movie was so much fun that it launched a series. Nobody thought of it was going to be anything more than a one-shot when it was made, but it became the first of what was probably the greatest buddy series in movie history.
It was a buddy series, but there was this interesting combination of, like, pals and rivals.
Oh, yeah. There was a relationship between them that they developed over the movies that was great. Bob was kind of the patsy, the nervous guy, the guy who chased women but never got them. He was always afraid. His sort of cowardly character was really developed there. And Bing was the cool customer, the schemer, the guy who always got the women. So there was this camaraderie, but this rivalry. It had tension, but it had real affection. It was just a terrific combination.
Let's hear a scene from the movie The Road to Morocco with Bob Hope and Bing Crosby. And this is like the opening scene. The premise is that the two of them were stowaways on a boat. And I think this is during World War II. So they're stowaways on a boat. The boat explodes, probably because Bob Hope had been smoking in the powder room, you know, where the ammunition was. So the boat explodes, and in the opening of the movie, Hope and Crosby are together in the middle of the ocean on a flimsy life raft with no food and no water. So Bing Crosby suggests that they flip a coin. Bob Hope loses, and Bing suggests what it is that Bing Crosby just won. So here's the scene.
Well, Junior, we got to face it. We may be days and days and days without seeing a ship or land. We're going to get hungry, mighty hungry.
What do you mean, get hungry?
We'll toss a coin. What's the date?
1910.
Pretty close, 1911. Well, that's the way it goes. Somebody loses, somebody wins.
Okay, so you win the nickel. See if you can find any white meat on that buffalo.
I got a TL for you. We tossed for something much deeper than that. I remember a story once about two fellas like us. Castaways. They tossed a coin, too.
Uh-huh.
They figured there's no use both of them starving.
Well, naturally.
The fellow who survived used to tell his grandchildren about his pal's sacrifice.
That's very interesting. Wait a minute. What pal's sacrifice?
I don't know, though. You should have eaten more oatmeal when you're a kid. You're kind of scrawny. There's no firmness there. I don't think you'd do me more than a week, and there's no icebox aboard.
Jeff, you're losing your buttons. You mean you'd eat me without vegetables?
Calm down now. Calm down, Junior. I'm not going to do anything right away. I might not do anything for a week or so. Not until I get desperate.
Oh, Jeff, you wouldn't like me once I bit my tongue and I tasted awful. Help, Jeff. Don't.
Turkey, look. Look. Am I seeing things?
What?
Look here.
Land!
What is that over there?
Land!
Yeah, so luckily they find land and Crosby doesn't have to eat Hope.
That makes me laugh still just hearing it. It was somewhat improvisational. There was no ad libs in the road pictures, but they would kind of take the script and then just build on gags. They would bring in their own writers to sort of try out different gags and do them on the set and just see what worked. And there was just so much chemistry there that they were terrific.
You know, the road movies, parts of them are really fun. Parts of them are really cringy because they take place in places like Zanzibar and Morocco. And there's something so ethnophobic about them. I mean, they're really, all the exotica stuff, it's really kind of embarrassing to to watch it now.
You know, you have to, it's true, they're somewhat racist, and the cannibals in Africa want to eat, you know, capture Hope and Crosby and want to eat them. And when you watch them, you know, dancing around like, you know, classic stereotyped, African savages, it is a little cringe-producing. But you do have to get past some of that.
You know, Bob Hope is such an interesting figure. And, you know, speaking personally, there's things about Bob Hope's performances that I just love. And there's other things that I find just, like, so not only cringeworthy, but kind of hateful. And I thought I'd play an example of that. And this is from 1970. It's a Bob Hope special. And I just want to prepare people. This is going to be very, very homophobic. And so this is Bob Hope in 1970, an example of why I think a lot of people grew up deeply disliking Bob Hope. Here we go.
And you know, a new movement has appeared on the American scene. First, women's liberation demanded the rights of women. Then the hard hats demanded the rights of men. And now gay liberation is demanding the rights of whatever they are. Now we got something else to worry about. Sissy power. I want to tell you, their leaders are really tough. They wear leather pantyhose. No, the gay liberation had a big parade in New York, and they floated down the avenue like Macy's Thanksgiving balloons. I'm not sure where the parade was. I think it was over in Queens. They actually tried to take over Alpine County out here in Northern California. It's true, they had their own sheriff, and he looked real good. He had boots, chaps, buckskin jacket, and pearls. And instead of handcuffs, he carried a slave bracelet.
So that was Bob Hope from a Bob Hope TV special recorded in 1970. And that's just really horrible.
Well, it's tough to defend that. I know. But, you know, he was an old-style comedian who used kind of standard comic targets. In the old days, it would be the cheap Scotsman or something. And here it was the effeminate homosexual. And he just didn't realize he crossed the line into, you know, real world political issues.
But that's the thing. It's like, it's not only homophobic jokes. It's like he didn't get it. And he didn't know that he didn't get it. And I'm thinking, though, at the beginning of our interview, you said that your previous book, which was all about comics who started performing in the 70s, including like Jerry Seinfeld and Richard Pryor, that none of them mentioned Bob Hope as an influence. And I think like that's maybe an example of why.
That is an example of why. And Bob Hope was the establishment. Bob Hope was friends with Nixon. Bob Hope was speaking out in favor of the war. Bob Hope was expressing that kind of backward suburban WASP kind of view of minorities, homosexuals, the women's movement. Even his comments on the women's movement were very condescending. He did a special in the 70s on the women's movement, and it was so silly, so backward, and the woman who was had some big political office was like dusting the chairs in between her meetings. It was just awful. And he got mail like that from feminists. And he was clueless at that time. And that was why, yes, that's exactly why that generation of comedians turned off to him.
Is part of your goal with your biography of Bob Hope to rescue him from himself?
Somewhat. You know, it was sad for me to see those kind of things. And I watched those specials from the 70s and the 80s, and oh man, you know, they're not very good. Everybody, he got to be lazy. He was reading off cue cards and just not connecting with his guests or the audience. It was very mechanical. So I can't really defend that, but you know, I think that I just feel he was such a major influence in the earlier years, and that his style was adapted and changed by the people who followed, but that you have to remember the founding fathers and the innovations that Bob made in stand-up comedy, and that even, you know, he was just a guy who got too powerful, too sort of big. He became royalty, and he was, as I said, friends with all the presidents. Nixon took him into the White House to tell him, explain to him why he was invading North Vietnam, so that Bob would go back out into the country and convey the message to help sell the country on his Vietnam policies. And, nobody else in comedy, you know, had anything like that kind of public role. And it's hard to be a comedian and be part of the establishment, because comedians, their job is to satirize and to poke fun at the powerful people, and that this is something that Bob was one of the powerful people. So just as a comedian, he became less and less relevant.
I want to thank you very much for talking with us. It's been fun to talk about Bob Hope.
Thanks a lot.
Richard Zoglin is the author of a new Bob Hope biography called Hope. You'll find the longer version of his conversation with Terry Gross online at freshair.npr.org. For better or worse, it's the time of year for new Christmas albums. Our rock critic Ken Tucker has been listening to a lot of them in genres ranging from pop to rock to soul. Here are his choices for the best of the batch.
It's the most wonderful time of the year, with the kids jingle belling and everyone telling you be of good cheer. It's the most wonderful time of the year.
That's Rufus Wainwright singing It's the Most Wonderful Time of the Year, a song popular in the 1960s in a similar version sung by Andy Williams. Wainwright plays it straight on the soundtrack album to a recent comedy film, A Merry Friggin' Christmas, starring Robin Williams and Joel McHale. The soundtrack features quite a few good original Christmas songs as well, such as this one by the Texas singer-songwriter Ryan Culwell, called It's Christmas Time, I Know, Ho Ho Ho.
Santa Claus is coming to town. Ain't no elf stopping at my house. Jingle bells and something else. I do my jingling all by myself. Hang a star on the evergreen. Maybe the nativity just ain't my scene. Yeah, it's Christmas time, I know. Ho, ho, ho.
Baby, the nativity just ain't my scene. That's a good line in a country pop song. There are a lot of Christmas albums out this year, and I've worked my way through a bunch of them, from Darius Rucker to the Blind Boys of Alabama with Taj Mahal to a two-disc Christmas at Downton Abbey. Its high point is Elizabeth McGovern, the Countess of Grantham herself, singing It Came Upon a Midnight Clear.
It came upon a midnight clear, that glorious song of old, from angels bending near the earth to touch their hearts of gold. Peace on the earth, goodwill to men, from heaven our gracious King. The world in silent stillness lay to hear the angels sing.
Another lively new collection is one from the veteran R&B group Earth, Wind & Fire called Holiday. It features singer Philip Bailey and the rest of the group working soulful variations on some old chestnuts, which could have been corny. Instead, it's pretty darn funky.
Somebody sing joy one more time.
Joy to the world.
Come on. Yes. And what?
And heaven and angels sing.
Yes.
And heaven and angels sing.
Yes.
And heaven and angels sing.
The best new Christmas album I've heard is from the folk group The Living Sisters. This female quartet's album, titled Harmony is Real, features fine versions of classics like Silver Bells and Little Drummer Boy. I am especially fond of this original tune, Merry Happy Christmas.
To a minor key, and you're itching to be heard, but there's never the right words, and you're kissing through all those salty tears. One of the ways that I get by, if it's the worst day of my life, I say
Christmas pop albums are always dicey propositions, with sentimentality frequently trumping spirit. But these albums get the tenor of the season as many of us experience it just about right. Some childlike enthusiasm, a dollop of earnest passion here, a little bit of savvy commercialism there. And like the best music, excellence or fun is never merely seasonal.
Ken Tucker is Fresh Air's rock critic. You'll find the list of all the Christmas albums he mentioned on our blog at nprfreshair.tumblr.com. Coming up, accordion player and composer Will Holzhauser performs music from his new album of French waltzes and dance music. This is Fresh Air Weekend. This is Fresh Air Weekend. I'm Dave Davies in for Terry Gross. We're going to listen to the interview Terry recorded recently with accordion player and composer Will Holzhauser. I'll let her introduce it.
When I was growing up, I thought of the accordion as a pretty corny and annoying instrument. Accordion meant the Lawrence Welk show, bad bar mitzvah bands, and, worse yet, my father's accordion lessons. But I wish I still had my father's accordion because I now realize what a remarkable instrument it is. My guest today, Will Holzhauser, takes full advantage of the instrument's possibilities. He has a magnificent accordion, and he brought it to our studio to play for us. Holzhauser has played all kinds of music on accordion, including Cajun, avant-garde jazz, indie rock, folk, klezmer, and styles from Argentina, Madagascar, and other countries around the world. His new album, Introducing Musette Explosion, features French waltzes and dances, as well as original songs in the Musette style. Let's start with the track A Recurring Dream. It features Marcus Rojas on tuba and Matt Munisteri on guitar. Music by Musette Explosion with my guest Will Holzhauser on accordion. Will, welcome to Fresh Air, and thank you for bringing your instrument with you. It's a beautiful accordion, and since I think most people don't have an accordion at home and don't get to see accordion very much, I'm assuming a lot of people aren't really familiar with what an accordion can really do and how it works. So give us a little tour of your very beautiful accordion.
Well, sure. Well, on the right side, there's a keyboard. It looks like a piano keyboard. And these keys, when you push a key, it opens a valve in the accordion. And that allows air to pass over metal reeds, which are inside the box. So one nickname for it is the squeeze box. So as you move the bellows back and forth, that generates the air. And then when you push the keys on the right hand or the buttons on the left hand, that lets the air through and the reeds sound. So my accordion has four sets of reeds. It can play very low notes on the right hand, or very high notes. If you there's these register switches, you can change the reed bank that's activated. So, and then there are two middle sets of reeds, which are slightly detuned. And you can also play all four sets together. So, and then the left hand has buttons, which in the standard accordion system are bass notes and chords. And this was invented in the 19th century to play music that did that. European music, and it's all based, of course, around the European tonal system. That system is called Stradella. There's a town in Italy called Stradella where it was invented. So it's a lot of fun. It's a very versatile instrument with a very wide range and wide dynamics. The dynamics come from the bellows, which it's often said the bellows in the accordion is like the bow of the violin. That's where you get dynamics, expression, and a whole host of other effects.
So manipulate the bellows differently to give us a sense of how the tone changes depending on how you're – what's the verb for what you do with the bellows? What's the right verb?
Bellowing.
Bellowing,
I suppose. But yeah. Well, it's mostly dynamics, but you can – the sound of the note does change as you change the air pressure.
So it's going from slow to fast in terms of what you're doing with the bellows?
Yeah. As you push harder, it gets louder as you push more air across the reed. And there's some special effects. If you open the valve halfway and push the air really hard, it can bend the pitch.
Wow. I didn't know you could bend notes on accordion. To bend notes on a keyboard instrument that's not a synthesizer, it's pretty...
Right.
Pretty good. So I should ask you to play a song for us.
Oh, okay.
And your new album, Introducing Musette Explosion, is all musette, which is a type of French song. Tell us what the genre is.
Well, it's basically French dance hall music from the first half of the 20th century. And it's led, the accordion is the lead instrument. The guitar is also very important. And one of the standard forms in this type of music is the waltz.
Okay, so you should play one of the musettes from your album for us. Do you want to do Swing Falls?
Sure, that sounds great.
What are you doing to your accordion?
Oh, I was just making sure that I had the right register on.
Okay.
Because you can, depending on which register you have, you can get, you know, in a different octave, or each one has a sort of different sound or different flavor.
And this is my guest, Will Holzhauser.
All right. This is Swing Valse, written by Baro Ferre and Gus Vizur.
So beautiful.
Thank you.
There's something very old-fashioned and avant-garde about the accordion. And let me see if I can explain that. It seems old-fashioned because in this era of like digital instruments and everything, like you're physically pumping air into it.
Mm-hmm,
you know, you're doing it manually to get the air over the reeds to create the sound. But there's something kind of avant-garde about it because you can get all these really unusual overtones through this array of buttons, almost as if it was some kind of either synthesizer or organ, where you're just creating unusual harmonics.
Mm-hmm. It's true. And especially, dissonance on the accordion, playing notes very close together, can bring out those overtones. And there is a whole range of effects you can get.
Go, show us some effects you can get.
All right. Well, here's some very high notes with special overtones. And if you shake the bellows, you can make it shimmer like that. You can do these bending notes like I showed you before. There's sort of nice clusters you can get.
Well,
letting
like
your
that.
Hand flop around on the keyboard like a fish. There's rhythmic things you can do with the bellows. Sometimes when I play for my daughter's class, I'll do a train effect. The kids like that.
I like that too.
Anyway, so that's done by shaking the bellows back and forth. So there are all kinds of things you can do. You know, you can use the breathing sound. And you just heard the bellows kind of squeezing, flopping together. So there's a whole bunch of effects you can get.
I love it. I love it. There's an original song I'm going to ask you to play that you do on your new album, The Musette Explosion. And this is an original song in the style of a French musette.
Mm-hmm.
And it's called Chanson Pop. which translates to pop song.
Yes.
So would you talk about composing it? And there's two different parts to the song. It's like a six-minute piece on the recording.
Mm-hmm.
I'm going to ask you to play an excerpt of the opening melody, and then we'll talk about that, and then we'll play an excerpt. I'm going to ask you to play an excerpt from Deeper In.
Okay.
So, but give us an overview of this piece and writing it and what your intention was.
Well, one of the kinds of work that I've really enjoyed doing as an accordionist in New York over the last 20 years or so is accompanying singers. And I've had great pleasure to accompany some singers that do French repertoire from the chanson tradition, which of course just means song. But it's, for example, the most famous exponent of the chanson tradition is Edith Piaf. And for a while, I was playing with a great singer from France named Michel Hermant, and I was the only accompanist. It was really fun because it was just vocals and accordion, so I was the entire backdrop. And he was very good at coaching me in developing these accompaniments. He said, "A song, one of these songs is like a movie. So this verse is one scene, and you need to create a backdrop. Maybe it's like a sunny day or something. Then the next verse or the next part of the song is totally different. Create a different backdrop." So to me, learning about that tradition, which is a little different from the Musette tradition. The Musette tradition is more the waltzes, the dances, the dance music. And the chanson tradition is more the poetic songwriting. There's some overlap. But this piece, I was thinking of some of those Piaf songs and not really trying to imitate them, but sort of trying to tap into the wonderful grandiosity of some of those pieces. So I'll play the opening melody first.
Perfect, yes.
Okay.
Beautiful. And that's Will Holzhauser in our studio playing the opening of his song Chanson Pop. And I know you said that that's based on like chanson, French song.
Mm-hmm.
To me, it sounds like it's also based on hymns.
Okay.
And I know that your father was a minister.
That's right.
And I imagine you heard a lot of hymns growing up. Do you hear a little hymn-like quality in that piece?
You're a very perceptive listener.
Aren't I?
Yes, absolutely. And that's really, for me, that's almost the very beginning of my musical life. My interest in music is going to church as a kid and hearing these hymns and feeling something stirring inside me that I couldn't describe. You know, feeling almost like a kind of truth or something that was a very direct experience and that I really couldn't put into words.
Let's close with another track from your new album, Musette Explosion. And there's a song that you do on it called Douce Joie, which means sweet joy. And one of the things I really like about this track is that, you know, the trio is made up of you on accordion, Matt Munisteri on guitar and sometimes banjo, and Marcus Rojas on tuba. And I don't think you associate tuba with French musette.
That's right. Yeah, it's not a part of the traditional style, but
nor do I associate it with accordion, with any accordion style.
Right. Well, it's there in maybe in polka music. you know.
Okay, sure.
But it is a lot louder than the accordion. But Marcus is such a master of the tuba, he can blend right in. And, you know, Matt and I started playing this music a long time ago, back in the 90s. And we played with bass players for a while. And at a certain point, you know, the bass role was almost too defined. So when we thought of playing with Marcus, we didn't just want a tuba player. We wanted Marcus. I'd been a big fan of his for a long time from Henry Threadgill Records and so forth. And Marcus can play the role of bass. He can also be a horn soloist, sound kind of like a French horn. He can make a whole lot of rhythmic effects, bird sounds, whale sounds. So, yeah, he's not just a tuba player. He's a tuba player that can bring a lot of creativity to any situation.
Well, I really like the interplay of the tuba and the accordion on this.
Oh, thanks.
Yeah. So let's hear it. Thank you so much for joining us and for playing for us. It's just really been terrific. I really appreciate it.
Thank you, Terry. My pleasure.
So this is Douce Joie from the new album Musette Explosion, featuring my guest Will Holzhauser on accordion.
Holzhauser's new album is called Introducing Musette Explosion. You'll find the longer version of his interview and performance online at freshair.npr.org. Fresh Air Weekend was produced by John Myers. Fresh Air's executive producer is Danny Miller. Our engineer and technical director is Audrey Bentham. Our interviews and reviews are produced and edited by Amy Sallet, Phyllis Myers, Roberta Shorrock, Anne-Marie Baldonado, Sam Brigger, Lauren Krenzel, John Sheehan, Heidi Simon, and Teresa Madden. Our administrative assistant is Dorothy Farabee. Molly C.V. Nesper is our associate producer for online media. For Terry Gross, I'm Dave Davies. The best.